Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm sorry if my voice is a little off today. I'm just recovering, but I think we can get through the entire show, and I'm happy to say that there's some interesting things. So let's get started with the must list. Poker Face, Netflix's Forever adaptation, and Kali Uchi's new album top this week's must list. Two new books, one by author Blair Fell and another by actress Angourie Rice and her mom, Kate Rice, round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. Hello from overseas! I'm in the midst of taking my mom on her first European adventure. And while I'm sure the Sound of Music tour we're likely currently on when you read this will be amazing, I'm going to use this letter to tout the joys of Paddington in Peru. I was late to the Paddington films, but they have become the perfect plane movies for me over the years. And I finally completed the trilogy on the flight to London last weekend. The world is a mess right now, and we could all use a little more Paddington in our lives. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. The first item on the list is Poker Face. No bull S here. The Rian Johnson-helmed whodunit series is back. This time around, Natasha Lyonne's Charlie is on the run from mob boss Beatrix Hasp, a delightfully evil Rio Perlman. And there's no shortage of weird cases for Charlie to use her impeccable lie-detecting superpowers on. Coming off a critically acclaimed first season, season two stacks the deck with a wild list of stars, including Cynthia Erivo, John Mulaney, Steve Buscemi, Katie Holmes, Kumail Nanjiani, Melanie Lynskey, and more. The first three episodes are out now on Peacock. Forever. In her adaptation of Judy Blume's classic young adult novel, Mara Brock Akil from Girlfriends tells the story of a bumpy romance between two L.A. teens, played by Lovie Simone and Michael Cooper Jr., in 2018. Brace for a bittersweet tale of first love and the challenges of raising exceptional Black kids in our modern era. Disco Witches of Fire Island. What are disco witches? Disco-obsessed witches, obviously. And this coven has used its magic for years to protect the gays of Fire Island. Meet them all in this fun romantasy by Blair Fell that glistens with queer magic even against the bleak background of the HIV/AIDS crisis. Kali Uchi's Sincerely. Kali Uchi is total soft girl vibes on her fifth album, her first since giving birth to her son in 2024, delivering an ethereal, dreamy sound on tracks such as Sunshine and Rain. The Colombian-American singer invites fans to immerse themselves in her more emotionally vulnerable side, reminiscent of her earlier work. And last, we have Stuck Up and Stupid. Mother-daughter duo Kate Rice and Angourie Rice from Mean Girls team up for this frothy summer retelling of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, where Lily's chill summer is disrupted when A-lister Dorian Kahn arrives and an unexpected romance strikes up between them. That is Poker Face, Netflix's Forever adaptation, and Kali Uchi's new album topping this week's must list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. And speaking of Poker Face, here is an exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. See Cynthia Erivo play quintuplets, including a catty DJ and an aloof French woman in Poker Face Season 2 clip. This is by Lauren Huff. What's better than one Cynthia Erivo? Five Cynthia Erivos, obviously. In the premiere episode of Poker Face Season 2, titled The Game is Afoot, series creator Ryan Johnson gives us just that. In it, Arrivo plays wildly different quintuplets, Bebe, Cece, Delia, Amber, and Felicity, and Entertainment Weekly has a delightful exclusive sneak peek of all the twinning. In the clip that's linked in the article, Natasha Lyonne's human lie detector character, Charlie, walks into a parlor where four of the five siblings have gathered. When she realizes there's an extra woman that wasn't there before, she quips, "Another one. Man, they've got to stop feeding these girls after midnight." One of them, a leather-clad mixed-media artist with piercings galore named Felicity, is explaining her background to her long-lost sisters, which include a catty DJ, a beanie-wearing hipster, and an aloof Frenchwoman. Apparently, Felicity has come into some money that the other siblings feel they are owed. The logline for the episode reads, "Even with a mob hit out on her, Charlie Kale can't help but get involved in investigating the seemingly innocent death of a friend's sister." To say much more than that would spoil the fun of the Mystery of the Week series, but for his part, Johnson, who also directs this particular puzzle, tells Entertainment Weekly that the second he knew Arrivo was available, he had to have her for this episode. "I've just admired her work for a long, long time and just really, really wanted the chance to work with her. And I knew she had the toolbox to actually pull this off, and she was game for it. And so, no, there was no question of anyone else. It was a no-brainer," he tells Entertainment Weekly. For him, shooting the episode is his most special memory from making season two, because the production of the show this time around overlapped with him shooting the next Knives Out movie, Wake Up, Dead Man. He was only available to direct this one episode this season. "I was still very involved in the writing and the editing, and I was in constant touch, but I was just as plugged into the show, but I was only able to physically be there to direct one. And so many of my memories are working with Cynthia and Natasha and Jinha and the other actors that we had in that episode. And just the pure pleasure of it," he says. Shooting the episode took 10 days, and to pull it off, Johnson utilized many, many different screens of Arrivo playing all of the different characters, much to Lyonne's amusement on set. "Cynthia and Ryan are so fun together. I mean, my God, Ryan, with all his screens looking at it, it's like the most Ryan Johnson thing I've ever seen Ryan Johnson do. He was all in on being Ryan Johnson on that episode, and I mean, it makes me really happy to see my friends do things like this." Johnson agrees, adding, "It was kind of the essence of why I wanted to do the show in the first place, and it was a really, really beautiful experience. So for me, that kind of encapsulates the experience of season two." Aside from Arrivo, expect an impressive slate of stars in the upcoming sophomore season, including John Mulaney, Aaliyah Shawkat, Awkwafina, Ben Marshall, BJ Novak, Carol Kane, Cliff Method Man Smith, Corey Hawkins, David Krumholtz, Davionte Gata Ganter, Ego Nwodum, Gabby Hoffman, Giancarlo Esposito, Haley Joel Osment, Jason Ritter, John Cho, Justin Thoreau, Catherine Narducci, Katie Holmes, Kevin Corrigan, Kumail Nanjiani, Margot Martindale, Melanie Linsky, Patty Harrison, Sam Richardson, Sherry Cola, Simon Rex, and more. The first three episodes of season two of Poker Face have already started streaming on Peacock. That was see Cynthia Arrivo play quintuplets, including a catty DJ and an aloof Frenchwoman in Poker Face season two clip. And it was by Lauren Huff. We heard about Forever, and here's a review. a magnificent modern reimagining of Judy Blume's classic. A new drama from Mara Brock Akil stars Michael Cooper Jr. and Lovie Simone as L.A. teens in love. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Forever, Judy Blume's 1975 classic novel about two New Jersey high schoolers falling in love and embarking on a sexual relationship, still gets banned to this day. At the time, Blume's depiction of teenage sexuality was considered both shocking and groundbreaking, and those of us who read it growing up are unlikely to forget it. 50 years after its release, Forever gets its first ever TV series adaptation from Mara Brock Akil, the creative force behind Girlfriends, The Game, Being Mary Jane, and more. In an era of Euphoria and other penis-happy prestige TV, the new Forever is comparatively tame. But Akil's creation, about two black teens in 2018 Los Angeles, makes its mark in other ways. While it encompasses all the butterflies and betrayals of first love, Forever also tells a deeper story about the challenges and heartache of raising exceptional black kids in our fraught modern era. Justin Edwards, played by Michael Cooper Jr., and Keisha Clark, played by Greenleaf's Lovie Simone, have a meet-cute over fondue at a New Year's Eve party thrown by Keisha's friend Chloe, played by Ali Gallo. Justin and Keisha went to grade school together, and though he doesn't remember her right away, he's instantly smitten. Keisha, now attending a predominantly black private school, is working toward a track scholarship at Howard University. Justin is struggling through the academic rigors of his mostly white private school, following the path his parents mapped out for him, Northwestern University, his mom's alma mater, and, with luck, a basketball scholarship. As senior year looms for both teens, a mutual infatuation starts to bloom. Akil and her writers take their time letting Keisha and Justin's story breathe. The first two episodes follow the teens through the stutter steps of their dance toward couplehood as miscommunications and misunderstandings keep their fledgling relationship from getting off the ground. The pacing can feel almost too leisurely in places, especially for viewers expecting swoony, sexy teen romance action from the outset. But over time, it becomes clear that Akil and her creative team, including Regina King, who directs the first episode, are telling a story not just about how young love unfolds, but how it feels. The camera lingers on the little moments, Justin's face lighting up when he spots Keisha in a crowd as she walks to meet him for a date, their fingers tentatively intertwining for the first time. The agonizing limbo of watching those three pulsating dots while waiting for a text back. Whether 50 years ago or today in the era of cell phones and social media, that anxiety is universal. What is my crush really thinking? Eventually, Keisha and Justin make their relationship Instagram official. Forever doesn't romanticize the teens' initial attempts to consummate their relationship, and instead chooses to depict those early encounters in all their halting and awkward glory. Blume's frank writing about teen sexuality and desire made Forever a young adult classic, but sex isn't the story engine here. On top of being hormone-addled teens blissed out with the magic of first love, Justin and Keisha are also saddled with the daunting expectations of their watchful parents, all of whom are determined to help their children excel in a world that wants to hold them back. Keisha is so terrified of disappointing her mom, Shelley, played by the Mindy Project's Shosha Rokmor, who works nights to pay for her private school, she never told her about an embarrassing event involving her ex-boyfriend, played by Xavier Mills, that still haunts her. Justin comes from an upper-class family. The Edwards live in a spacious hilltop house with a pool and spend a month every summer on Martha's Vineyard. Still, his parents, Don, played by the morning show's Karen Pittman, an executive with a self-professed catastrophic parenting style, and Eric, played by The Wire's Wood Harris, a laid-back restaurant owner and chef, know that unlike Justin's white peers, money doesn't necessarily guarantee him an easy path to success. "You are a black man in America," Dawn warns her son. "You need to be undeniable." Though forever is Keisha and Justin's story, Akil and her writers give a considerable amount of weight to the parents, especially Eric and Dawn. It seems ludicrous to write this in 2025, but the Edwards clan, a well-to-do suburban black family, are still very much a rarity on TV, and there's a power in the way Akil's characters don't just exist, they thrive. Episode 5, titled The Vineyard, centers on Justin and Keisha's reconciliation after a fight, but the power of that reunion is rivaled by the joyful scenes of Eric, Dawn, and their family and friends enjoying a sun-drenched and intoxicating day at their sprawling summer home. Even on vacation, though, Dawn can't stop worrying about what it will take to get Justin into Northwestern. As she laments to her brother Charlie, played by Rodney Hicks, "It ain't easy getting these kids to the dream." Like Bloom's novel, Akil's adaptation sets its story of a momentous first love against the backdrop of the exhilarating, pivotal, and terrifying period that is senior year of high school. But for Justin and Keisha's parents, securing their children a spot at a good college isn't just a routine stop on the pathway to adulthood, it's an accomplishment born of generational sacrifice. "You are a first, get it?" a tearful Eric tells Justin. "Your great-grandfather picked cotton." Akil understands that young love isn't just an emotional whirlwind for teenagers, it's a profound experience for parents too. Wood and Pittman are phenomenal. Honestly, it felt like a privilege to watch them embody Eric and Dawn, characters who are complex, funny, determined, flawed, loving, and thoroughly relatable. Netflix's Classified Forever as a drama rather than a limited series, and I'd be all in on a season 2 that follows their marriage. Simone is magnetic as Keisha, who is at once a responsible, driven young woman and a giddy, infatuated girl who scribbles Justin's name down in her notebook during class. Cooper Jr. gives a star-making performance as Justin. The newcomer captures his character's shy, oddball charm, and he brings an endearing authenticity to Justin's growing confidence and vulnerability. Despite the heady rush of first love and the thrill of sexual exploration, Justin and Keisha develop a deep, profound friendship, and it's impossible not to root for them. Anyone who's read the book, or, you know, lived through adolescence, will not be surprised by the trajectory of Justin and Keisha's story. As Dawn reminds her son, "Sometimes love does the hard thing." Young love doesn't always last, but with Forever, Akil gives us far more sweet than bitter. That was a review of Forever, a magnificent modern reimagining of Judy Blume's classic. It was by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving the show a grade of B+. Also in the reviews is Nona's. Vince Vaughn, Lorraine Bracco, and more cook up special sauce in this good vibes Netflix comedy. What's Italian for schmaltz? This is by Jordan Hoffman. Nobody ever cooked you better tasting food than your grandmother. That's true, even if her skills were limited to a bowl of Rice Krispies. But if she came from a heritage that emphasized rich cuisine and homemade recipes passed down through generations, like, oh, I don't know, Italians, forget about it. One must be forewarned not to press play on Netflix's enjoyable new feature known as, that's streaming now, On an Empty Stomach. It's all of 3 seconds before you'll be looking at near pornographic images of cannoli, zeppoli, and my favorite, chocolate-covered rainbow cookies mixed with almond paste with layers of raspberry jam. Madonna, what I'd do for a white box of those wrapped in string right now. Then there's a big Sunday meal with homemade pasta and tomato sauce. This is set in Brooklyn, not Jersey, so it's definitely sauce, not quote-unquote gravy, and a triumphant lasagna presented in a white and blue Corningware dish. Nona's is to Italian food what Top Gun Maverick is to fighter jets. And director Steven Chbosky and cinematographer Florian Bauhaus have, if nothing else, done the impossible by creating a movie you can smell. Luckily, it's not just the pastries that are sweet. The film, loosely based on a true story, follows Joe Scaravella, played by Vince Vaughn, as a sensitive Brooklyn mechanic, taking the grief of losing his mother and using it to create a restaurant that honors his family's tradition. The gimmick of the place, and the movie, is that he won't hire professional chefs. He'll hire actual Italian grandmothers, nonas, to do what they do best, cook from the heart, and also periodically scream, "Basta!" and create senior citizen mayhem while the soundtrack plays Funiculi Funicula and the Tarantella. Yes, this movie is corny as all hell, but the truth is I was sold before the first antipasto hit the table. And you would think I was chopping up onions myself by the way my eyes got all misty watching Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn? Talk about his late mother and grandmother. Formulaic, dare I say, sappy movies, when done right, can really be good. And Nona's is one such example. The main course of all this comes after introducing the four Nonas Joe hires, then letting them do their thing in the kitchen. The first is Lorraine Bracco's Roberta, his mother's best friend, a passionate Sicilian now raising hell in a nursing home. Then there's Brenda Vaccaro's Antonella, a Bolognese just as tough as Roberta, and the neighbor and mother figure to Olivia, played by Linda Cardellini, who happens to be Joe's old high school flame. While Roberta and Antonella shout and curse at each other, at one point literally hurling tomatoes in anger, with Bracco using Italian bread as a bat to swat them away, there's balance from the stuttering calm of Talia Shire's ex-nun Teresa. And finally, Susan Sarandon as Gia, the Italian Blanche Devereaux, who naturally serves up dessert. The central conflict of Nona's is watching Joe's bills pile up before his new venture takes off. By his side is Bruno, played by Joe Manganiello, a contractor who helps upgrade the old Staten Island dump he bought, and Bruno's wife Stella, played by Drea De Matteo, whose primary function is to pronounce the word talk as talk every few scenes. You'd have to be a little stunned to think a movie like this isn't going to work out nicely, but with all these nice ingredients simmering, Nona's ends up being a real treat. The best moments come from the specifics, the walks through the farmer's market, close-ups of a blanched tomato, Roberta calling breadcrumbs crumbs of bread, and learning about capuzelle, which is lamb's head that definitely looks a little questionable. I will call this movie out, however, for a bit of bad New York geography. Joe and Bruno are supposed to live in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, but the restaurant is in Staten Island. Yes, it is far more photogenic for them to take the Staten Island ferry, but that's a million miles out of the way. Take the Verrazano! Which Gavone mapped this out? Did this annoy me? Yes. Did I get over it the second I shouted at the screen? I didn't mean any disrespect. Pass the skungili. It's made with 16 cloves of garlic. That is the Nona's review. Vince Vaughn, Lorraine Bracco, and more cook up special sauce in this good vibes Netflix comedy. It was by Jordan Hoffman, who's giving the show a grade of B+. This is a good moment to take a quick break to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Next, we have a list, and it's a good one. The best movies based on children's books from Little Women to The Wizard of Oz. Some films are truly as good as their source material. This is by David Canfield and Kevin Jacobson. There's always a bit of tension when it comes to filmmakers adapting books that people adore, especially for beloved children's books that leave an indelible mark on readers at an early age. But some movies really do honor the feeling and message of their source material and show why the author's words are so rich with cinematic potential. Certain classics, like Little Women, have been adapted multiple times, with each generation of moviegoer getting their definitive version. Some movies have become treasured childhood favorites of their own, such as The Wizard of Oz and Mary Poppins, arguably overshadowing the books on which they were based. Here are our favorite children's book-to-screen adaptations over the years. The first in the list is The Secret Garden from 1993. Polish filmmaker Agnieszka Holland gave audiences a widely celebrated adaptation of Frances Hodgson Burnett's 1911 book. Not the only director to interpret this classic for the screen, her vision maintains the original's deliberate pace and dark themes, infusing it with a gorgeous Gothic atmosphere and sprinkling it with crucial notes of joy and humor. Legendary cinematographer Roger Deakins expertly realizes the Secret Garden's mysterious core, while Maggie Smith is, as ever, a scene-stealing delight in the role of Mrs. Medlock. Matilda from 1996. Roald Dahl's classic has spawned a celebrated audiobook read by Kate Winslet, a Broadway musical, and several film iterations, the best known and most beloved of which has to be Danny DeVito's 1996 version. The warm, spiritually faithful adaptation wasn't a huge hit when it premiered. Its domestic gross couldn't even match a $36 million budget. But it has endured as a significant part of one of the most popular children's franchises out there. Little Women from 1994. Louisa May Alcott's famed accounting of four sisters growing together from childhood to adulthood was transformed into awards bait in this 1994 adaptation. Directed by Gillian Armstrong, Little Women stars Winona Ryder in an Academy Award-nominated performance, and while maintaining the family-friendly nature of the source material, it's rated PG. The film takes on the hue of Hollywood prestige, a lush cinematic treatment of mid-19th century America. Then there's Little Women 2019. We tend to think that Greta Gerwig's innovative, impassioned adaptation is the best cinematic take on Louisa May Alcott's novel to ever hit the screen. Saoirse Ronan, and Florence Pugh fiercely lead the charge as March sisters Joe and Amy, but this is a total collaboration, from lush cinematography to a rousing score from Alexander Desplat, and Gerwig's command is unmatched. Holes from 2003. Louis Sacher adapted his wildly popular mystery novel himself for Andrew Davies' 2003 screen adaptation. The movie stars Shia LaBeouf, Patricia Arquette, and Sigourney Weaver, with Sackler maintaining the book's penchant for surprise, suspense, and giddy momentum. Indeed, it's a faithful reimagining all around, right down to the sharp humor and edginess that gives the original novel some punch. Coraline from 2009. Neil Gaiman reached out to director Henry Selick directly to make the film adaptation of his spooky children's novel, thinking he would be a good fit given his previous directorial efforts, 1993's The Nightmare Before Christmas and 1996's James and the Giant Peach. The result is a gorgeous stop-motion rendering of the source material, which follows an 11-year-old girl named Coraline, who moves with her family into a new house that contains a portal to an alternate universe. Compelled by this idyllic other world, the curious preteen soon discovers there may be a sinister secret behind it all. Coraline features terrific voice performances by Dakota Fanning and Terry Hatcher, and a tone that perfectly rides the line between creepy and spellbinding. The Harry Potter films, 2001 to 2011. Kids of the Harry Potter generation grew up with J.K. Rowling's landmark novel series just as much as they did with the enormously successful film franchise. Though the original eight movies were helmed by a collection of directors, featuring two different actors as Dumbledore, and varying mildly in quality from one movie to the next, the fact is that the Harry Potter films instantly emerged as essential companion pieces, rousing tales of wizardry that rightfully launched Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson to stardom. Potter fandom remains alive and well more than a decade after the publication of Deathly Hallows, and the movies are no small reason why. A Little Princess from 1995. The film that put Alfonso Cuarón from Gravity on Hollywood's radar, A Little Princess marks another brilliantly executed take on the Frances Hodgson Burnett classic. The Mexican-born director employs magical realism to stunning effect in this story of a young girl resigned to a life of servitude in a New York boarding school. It's a playful, charming family movie, unafraid of naturalism or aesthetic ambition, and an early indication of why Cuarón is one of the best filmmakers working today. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory from 1971. Mel Stewart's alternately haunting, awe-inspiring, and flat-out hilarious adaptation of Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory helped to inspire a whole candy company. The timeless story was brought to surreal and colorful life in the 1971 movie, introducing generations of viewers to everything from chocolate rivers to Oompa Loompas to everlasting gobstoppers. And the late Gene Wilder gave an iconic performance as the eponymous Candyman, one that Johnny Depp could not live up to in Tim Burton's misguided 2005 remake. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, from 2023. It took 53 years for Judy Blume's foundational coming-of-age novel to be adapted to film, but writer-director Kelly Freeman Craig's interpretation proves how universal and timeless Blume's story really is. Set in 1970, the film follows the titular Margaret, played by Abby Ryder Fortson, an 11-year-old navigating the anxieties of puberty on top of family struggles. The book has long been lauded for its direct discussion of menstruation and other facts of life not found in children's literature, and the film is a frank yet loving ode to Bloom's vision. Special shout out to Rachel McAdams as Margaret's mother, who delivers one of her warmest and most complex performances to date. The Railway Children from 1970. The directorial debut of actor Lionel Jeffries, The Railway Children was a genuine breakthrough in children's book adaptations. Jeffries took on Elizabeth Nesbitt's story of the Waterbury Children back in 1970, translating it into a warm, sprawling, and deeply satisfying portrait of pre-World War I London. Now considered a UK classic, The Railway Children is currently ranked 66th on the British Film Institute's top 100 British films. Where the Red Fern Grows from 1974. It didn't take too long for Hollywood to acquire rights to Wilson Rawls's 1961 children's novel, Where the Red Fern Grows. Directed by Norman Tokar and released in 1974, the film version is a nicely packaged, not especially surprising take on the book. James Whitmore and Beverly Garland are among the main cast, one reason the film works best now as a nostalgic viewing experience. The Iron Giant from 1999. Loosely based on the 1968 novel of the same name by Ted Hughes, this beloved animated film from writer-director Brad Bird is a highly emotional parable about a boy and the 50-foot robot, voiced by Vin Diesel, he discovers in the woods. It's the 1950s during the Cold War, and after the boy finds that the robot is friendly, he does his best to protect him from being misused or destroyed by the government. The Iron Giant soars above other animated films released in the 90s for its transporting nature and relative maturity. The Witches from 1990. There are several reasons to check out The Witches, Nicholas Raeg's wild Roald Dahl adaptation, but there's one in particular that trumps them all, Anjelica Huston. In one of her best performances, the actress goes gloriously over the top as the Grand High Witch, a work of high camp that matches the film's unusual tone perfectly. But while this ranks as a strong adaptation all around, Dahl didn't exactly see it that way. Per BBC News, he called this Witches utterly appalling. Though remade for Max in 2020, Anne Hathaway could not surpass Huston's iconic take as the head of the titular terrors. Where the Wild Things Are from 2009. Indie stalwart Spike Jonze brought his original directorial voice to Maurice Sendak's acclaimed book of the same name, and the results were quietly stunning. The evocative, intensely emotional film features exceptional contributions from all sides of the production process, from Carter Burwell's lyrical score to co-screenwriter Dave Eger's personal touch to the delicate transformations of James Gandolfini, Lauren Ambrose, and others into Wild Things. New York Times critic A.O. Scott named it one of the top five films of the 2000s. The Wizard of Oz from 1939. It isn't every children's book adaptation that ranks among the best American films ever made, and MGM's ambitious take on L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz is indeed one of the very few. The Judy Garland starrer is a movie musical of multiple iconic songs and performances, and through its memorable characters and groundbreaking use of Technicolor, it has steadily emerged as one of the signature examples of American popular culture. The Jungle Book, 1967 and 2016. Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book is the rare book to spawn multiple excellent adaptations. First, most notably, is the 1967 version animated by Disney, which introduced Mowgli, Baloo, and the rest of the Jungle Gang to the masses. But Jon Favreau directed an impressive, imaginative remake in 2016, making spiffy use of CGI in order to make the story's anthropomorphic animals a little more lifelike. We have an overall theme here of classic Disney fairy tales. Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, Snow White, The Little Mermaid. It's hard to think of a more trailblazing group of children's movies than what peak Disney had to offer. These fairy tale films span decades. The first, Snow White, is from the 30s. The most recent, Beauty and the Beast, from the early 90s. And yet, taken together, it's a satisfying, compatible group that works perfectly as a marathon binge. Disney's recent efforts to spin these tales into live-action epics have had mixed results, however, to say the least. The Princess Bride from 1987. Rob Reiner's uproariously fun Princess Bride has only increased in stature over the years as a defining piece of 80s pop culture, eminently quotable, "You killed my father," etc., and deliciously memeable. It's another example of an author adapting his own work, with William Goldman skillfully transforming his fantasy romance into even more of a romp. The Princess Bride was not a significant box office success back when it premiered, but it still managed to shape plenty of childhoods. Mary Poppins from 1964. The beloved Disney adaptation was very loosely based on P.L. Travers' series of books, though as memorably documented in the 2013 movie Saving Mr. Banks. She was intimately involved with the making of the movie. Whatever tension and differences around in the lead-up, of course, the finished product was a thing of movie magic, with Julie Andrews bringing the umbrella-twirling nanny to heartwarming life. Anne of Green Gables from 1934. It's no wonder, given how hugely popular L.M. Montgomery's Anne of Green Gables continues to be, that studios and networks have turned to the book as entertainment material again and again. The most notable of the films is George Nicholas Jr.'s 1934 version, a surprise hit which led actress Dawn O'Day to change her stage name to, wait for it, Anne Shirley. But there are others worth your time, including Netflix's surprisingly dark, if equally engrossing, TV series, which premiered in March 2017. Watership Down from 1978. One of the most dramatically impressive takes on a children's favorite, Martin Rosen's animated Watership Down, adapted from the Richard Adams novel, is arguably the only film on this list that's very clearly targeted toward an adult audience. The gorgeous animation and drops of animal humor can't quite shield the grim violence and horror put on display throughout, and the independent financing makes way for that rare kind of animated movie that's unhurried, even poetic, in its attempts to grab your attention. Fantastic Mr. Fox from 2009. Anyone who's seen Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox should know that it's as artistically definitive as a treatment of a picture book as you're going to find. Anderson's screwball but meticulous aesthetic turns out to be a perfect fit with Roald Dahl, the idiosyncratic humor coming through in surprising ways and the narrative gaining some weirdly thrilling momentum. Plus, the voice cast is hard to beat. George Clooney and Meryl Streep are the ideal Fox couple, while Anderson movie regulars Bill Murray and Willem Dafoe make wonderful contributions in supporting roles. Peter Pan from 1953. J.M. Barrie's The Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up is, at this point, known to be a notoriously dark tale, at least relative to the original. While Barrie digs into Peter Pan's psyche and behavior rather unsparingly, the Disney film the character spawned nearly 50 years later isn't so cynical. Instead, the wondrous Peter Pan introduced Neverland, Tinkerbell, and more to the world. Things so beloved they served as the inspiration for a theme park ride. The Neverending Story from 1984. Wolfgang Peterson's poignant take on the Neverending Story might slightly lack the depth and sophistication of its source material, Michael Ende's expansive fantasy novel, but the result is still enchanting escapism, with effects and tricks that hold up pretty well. Indeed, despite the film's combined age and visual ambition, this is a crowd-pleasing family film that hasn't lost its luster. Shrek from 2001. Shrek is such a wildly original, globally beloved work of pop culture as a movie that its origins as a very good fairy tale picture book by cartoonist William Steig are easily forgotten. The hugely successful movie certainly birthed the major franchise for DreamWorks, but it still stands out because of the little things. Those ridiculously memorable music cues, the finely tuned voice performances of Mike Myers and Eddie Murphy, and of course, the eccentric supporting cast. Hugo from 2011. First published in 2007, Brian Selznick's The Invention of Hugo Cabret is the most recent book on this list, and Martin Scorsese's adaptation marks a thrilling change of pace for one of our greatest living directors. It's an astonishingly smooth transition for Scorsese, maintaining his incomparable skills as a filmmaker while also replacing grit with glamour. The movie is full of visual decadence and thematic intrigue, and of enough interest to adults to net Best Picture and Director nominations at the Oscars, while still projecting a sense of wonder. It's also one of the most emotionally absorbing children's movies of the 2010s. How the Grinch Stole Christmas. This is from 1966. Okay, so Chuck Jones's animated adaptation of Dr. Seuss's holiday classic was technically released on television, and by clocking in at a hair under 30 minutes, it's not exactly a feature-length movie either. But the film has become such a staple of holiday viewing for children and adults alike, and is so smartly made as a comedy and a fable, that it felt wrong not to include it. Plus, we weren't about to go with that Jim Carrey version instead. Ernest and Celestine from 2012. Based on the Belgian book series of the same name by Gabriel Vincent, Ernest and Celestine is quite distinct compared to the studio-backed American films on this list. It's a gentle, thoughtful, profound, and elegant work of animation that boasts an offbeat sense of humor, lots of animal dentistry commentary here, and sweetness that never dips into saccharine. In its exploration of friendship and tolerance, however, the Oscar-nominated film boasts the same universality and accessibility as the better-known adaptations out there. And phew, last on the list, Howl's Moving Castle from 2004. Animation legend Hayao Miyazaki adapted Diana Wynne Jones's 1986 novel of the same name to tell a potent anti-war story. The film begins with a young hatmaker named Sophie as she encounters a witch who transforms her into a 90-year-old woman. Sophie sets out to find a way of lifting the curse and goes to the wizard Howl's castle. But she soon finds herself involved in Howl's pacifist efforts amid the ongoing war and develops a unique relationship with the mercurial young wizard. Like many Miyazaki films, Howl's Moving Castle can be enjoyed by kids and adults alike for its strikingly beautiful imagery, memorable characters, Calcifer, and powerful themes. That was quite a list. I think that I'll check some of those out that I haven't seen in a long time. Those were the best movies based on children's books from Little Women to The Wizard of Oz. And it was by David Canfield and Kevin Jacobson. And something that should just about finish up the time we have available is about, well, one of the classics as far as I'm concerned. Christina Applegate looks back on the complete flop, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. I feel very proud about it now. The actress regrets her attitude from the era, declaring herself an asshat. This is by Jordan Hoffman. Christina Applegate and Jamie Lynn Sigler read some emails from listeners on the latest episode of their podcast, Messy with Christina Applegate and Jamie Lynn Sigler, and seized upon one in part because it was short. Would Christina be willing to talk about her role in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead? It was my favorite movie growing up. Thanks. Indeed, Applegate was right on top of that. She seemed eager to explain that she's now proud of the 1991 movie, which was neither a critical nor box office success at the time, but has since emerged as a cult favorite. As such, she's considerably regretful of how she sneered at the whole experience back in the day. I didn't want to do it because it was a commercial film. I was so into indies back then. I was like, I'm only going to do independent film acting, Applegate said, deploying a fake above-it-all voice. I was such a effing asshat. The Married with Children star continued, I needed a job, man. Did you have fun? Sigler, who counts herself as one who loves the movie, asked. I did. I had some personal stuff going on off the scenes, which will be in the book, that were pretty horrific. So there were some really hard days. But yeah, I loved everybody. But at the same time, I was still like, this is like selling out, she explained, slipping into her faux obnoxious voice, which sounds like a weird cross between a Gen Z TikToker and Butthead of Beavis and Butthead fame. And then it went and made no money at all, she continued, like it came out and was a complete flop. And here we are, I'm 53 years old. I was 18 when I did it, I think, 18 or 19, and people are still quoting that movie, and I've watched it with my daughter a gajillion times. Applegate shared that her daughter not only loves the movie, but has also developed an appreciation for her character. She loves when Sue Ellen was just swell and my ring game was so rad, she says. That was how I wore rings. As for her overall wardrobe, Applegate reflected, that's how I wore clothes. Like, I wore Dr. Martens, but obviously the shoulder pads and stuff were real embarrassing to me. I was always embarrassed by the fashion show because I was like, couldn't we have had it be actually cool fashion and not, like, weird? But that was the movie. Incidentally, Don't Tell Mom's costume designer Carol Ramsey is still in the biz all these years later and worked on 5 Merchant Ivory productions. Shoulder pads aside, though, Applegate is quick to point out, what movie has a bunch of drag queens steal their car? And people quote it all the time. The dishes are done, man. And all that stuff. I feel very proud now about it. I just hated what an asshole I was at the time. She clarified, I wasn't mean to anyone. I was just like, I just want to do independence. Oh God, you know what you do when you do independence? You don't make any effing money. How about that? She declared. Nobody ever sees those, Siegler added. You make like $2. After that, I was like, yes, commercial movies are the way to go. I'm going to make money now. Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dad was recently remade as a BET Plus original film starring Simone Joy Jones, Nicole Richie, and June Squibb. You can hear the entirety of the latest messy episode linked in, it's a podcast and it's linked in the Entertainment Weekly article. That was Christina Applegate looks back on complete flop, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dad. I feel very proud now about it. And it was by Jordan Hoffman. Well, that wraps up our time for this week's reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Thank you for listening this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please come back next week to hear what I found. But until then, goodbye.